Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Creation Podcast, where we discuss the science that confirms Scripture. I'm your host, Renee, and you're listening to the second episode of a two-part series on biblical longevity. Scripture describes humans living for a very long time before and directly after the flood, sometimes nearly 1,000 years. Skeptics, of course, scoff at these numbers, saying they're a reason to disregard the Bible. Even some Christians say these long ages can't be taken literally. But is that really true? In the last episode, we looked at some of the scientific and historical evidence for ancient human longevity. In this episode, we're going to ask the question, might it be possible for creation scientists to one day explain this extreme longevity? Joining me to answer these questions and more is ICR physicist Dr. Jake Hebert. Thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm delighted to be here, Renee. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really excited to be able to talk more about this with you today. And so before getting into attempts to explain this longevity, can we recap some of the evidence that we talked about in the last episode?
Okay. Well, there are extra-biblical sources, historical references, cultural traditions that people live to be really old. But there's also scientific evidence. People who've studied animal longevity, there have been a lot of studies over the years, and two of the trends that keep showing up is that the bigger you are, the longer you live. Okay, organisms that have larger adult body sizes tend to live longer, and the longer it takes you to become an adult, the longer you live. Those are these general trends that you see. So do we see evidence of that in the fossils? Yes, absolutely. We see it. The giantism in the fossil record is all over the place. Many creatures, and not just dinosaurs, but many creatures that are still around today were much larger in the past. And I'll give you an example. Coelacanth. You know, the coelacanth is famous as a living fossil. Today, it never gets to be more than 1.8 meters long. They've got some in the fossil record they think were 5 meters long. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about that is if you double the body length, the body mass becomes roughly 8 times greater. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's interesting is if your biological time, well, anyway, I'm getting off track here, but again, you got giantism. You got giantism in the fossil record. You've got evidence for delayed maturation. There's evidence in some of these oysters that this basic Genesis kind of oyster called the Crassostrea oyster, they were much bigger in the past. You've got giant fossil versions that are twice as big as the ones that we have now. They were taking longer to mature. You have modern day ones that can take maybe 6 years to mature. During the Ice Age, they were probably taking 9 years, but in the fossil record, which we think was, we're looking at some that we think are from the flood, they were living to be 20 or 23 years old, and actually they could have been living longer than that. Another example that I didn't mention is there's preliminary evidence that some of these giant crocodile-like creatures also took very long to mature. There's a creature called the Deinosuchus that's been sort of described as a kind of giant alligator-like animal. It may not be a true alligator, but it's very similar. But Brian Thomas, for instance, my colleague here at ICR, thinks it might have been the Leviathan, the biblical Leviathan. Wow. But people have done growth curves for the Deinosuchus, and it looks like it was taking at least 50 years to become an adult. Okay, now today, most crocodiles don't live past 30. Now, there's a few exceptions, but most of them don't even live past 30. So if you've got something that's already living to be 50 and it's still growing, that's an indication that it was living longer. The same thing is true for another giant crocodilian called the Sarcosuchus imperator. Some people have said maybe this was the Leviathan too.
Sounds intimidating.
Evolutionists have estimated it took 40 to 60 years to become an adult. So these things are huge, like 10 meters long.
Wow.
Okay. Huge, huge. And what's even more interesting is we know for a fact that there were giant crocodiles. You could quibble and say, is the Deinosuchus a true crocodile? Well, maybe not. And we don't, as far as I know, we don't have any growth curves for these giant crocodiles per se. But we do know that they were big, humongous, with comparable body sizes to the Sarcosuchus and the Deinosuchus. So it's a good bet they were probably taking, and they look like giant versions of crocodiles that are around today. You've got these things that are called gharials that have these long, narrow snouts. They're still around today. You've got some in the fossil record, but they're giants, okay? And they probably took a long time to mature and probably had long lifespans. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. There's evidence in the fossils. Most of it's indirect, but there's even a little bit of direct evidence that they were living longer. The animals were as well, not just the people.
Wow. Well, we're living in a really exciting time where we're getting to uncover a lot of this evidence. And I know that your previous research was just a little bit different, focused on the Ice Age. Right. So how did you get into researching the evidence for longevity specifically? What was that pivot? What did that
Well,
like?
I've always kind of been fascinated by giantism. Mm-hmm. And the reason, it's kind of weird. My PhD research was weather/climate related, but the reason I picked that was because I was interested in the pre-flood world and what is it that's causing that giantism and the longevity. I was mainly interested in giantism, but the longevity as well. And I've long suspected it had something to do with the atmosphere. And a lot of other creationists have suspected that as well. That may not be the whole answer, but that's part of it. So the whole reason I picked that particular PhD research topic was mainly because I was interested in this topic. Okay. So, of course, that kind of led into the Ice Age meteorologies kind of stuff. And so for the last 10 years, I've been working primarily on the Ice Age. But as a lot of our supporters know, that ICR has recently had a big push on biology. And as a result of that, Dr. Galuza, our president, he asked me to look into this issue of biological scaling, which is the question of why are organisms the sizes that they are? Why are different body parts the sizes that they are? And I've long been interested in that because I thought that might somehow connect to the giantism. Yeah. And so I said, okay. So I started working on it. And at first, it wasn't obvious that there was a connection to longevity. But as I started doing more and more research, I started seeing evidence of these trends that suggest that the giantism might be connected to greater longevity. And so that's kind of how I got into this.
Wow, that is really, really neat. And so we talked about this in a little bit in the last episode, but do you, with your physics background, have any ideas for how to explain this longevity from a creationist perspective?
Yeah, I do, actually. Now, again, the full explanation may be a combination of factors. I strongly suspect the atmosphere had something to do with mm-hmm. it. Now, I don't believe in the vapor canopy. Now, I used mm-hmm. to. When I came to ICR, I was a big vapor canopy fan. You know, there's this idea that before the flood, there was this canopy of vapor over the atmosphere, and they think somehow, you know, that may have contributed to the rain, may have contributed to the longevity, the giantism. Most creationists don't believe that anymore. Mainly, for me, the main argument is scriptural, because when you talk about this, the waters above the firmament, you got to figure out what the firmament is. Okay, now firmament's actually a bad translation. The expanse is probably a better rendering of that Hebrew word. But the Bible actually says the stars are in the expanse or in the firmament. So if you say that the vapor canopy is the waters above and the firmament is Earth's atmosphere, you got a problem because we know there aren't stars in our atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, most creationists think that it's actually talking about basically, you know, the word, the firmament or the expanse is basically the sky. It includes the atmosphere, but it also includes outer space. So most creationists think that when it talks about the waters above, it's talking about the shell of water way out in deep space beyond the farthest galaxies. Nevertheless, even though I don't hold to that view anymore, I still strongly suspect the atmosphere has got something to do with it. Maybe there was a little more oxygen. Maybe it was a thicker atmosphere. I'm not sure, but I think that's got something to do with it. So the question is now, what approach? Let me get back to this. Should I even be working on this? Right, I'm not a biologist. You know, I get queasy at the sight of blood. You know, I fainted in the past. Should I even be working on this? Right, I mean, I'm a physicist. Do I have any business working on this? Well, I think I do. And the reason for that is there is a physicist out there named Jeffrey West, and he and a couple of biologists named Brian Enquist and John Brown have done a lot of theoretical research in scaling, why things are the body sizes that they are. Now, they're evolutionists, and they interpret everything with an evolutionary worldview, but they were able to explain some very significant features of the cardiovascular and respiratory systems by assuming that it's designed to be energy efficient. And they were able to turn the crank, and it's a relatively crude model, but they were able to derive some basic things about life history. There's a well-known rule in biology called Kleber's rule. It has to do with something called your basal metabolic rate. Now, what's basal metabolic rate? Well, that's your metabolic rate when you're just resting, not doing anything. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're just sitting there, not doing anything. And for a long time, people have noticed that basal metabolic rate, it's related to mass, but again, it's not a one-to-one relationship. Mm-hmm. If you double the mass, you don't double the metabolic rate. But if you double the mass, the metabolic rate becomes 68% larger. Okay. Yeah. So it's like it's a power relationship where the exponent is 3/4. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they were able to derive, they were able to come up with a theoretical justification for that. And what I'm really interested in is that they were able to then take that and they were able to do some work on what we call ontogeny. Life history, you know, how long does it take an organism to become an adult? How long does it take to grow? Things like that. And I mentioned earlier in the previous podcast, there's a bunch of experimental evidence that biological timescales tend to go as body mass raised to the 1/4 power. And that can be things like how long it takes your blood to circulate. It can be your total lifespan. It can also be how long it takes you to become an adult. Mm. They were able to derive that the time to become an adult goes as body mass raised to the 1/4 power.
Wow.
So you've got experimental justification for that. Now you've got theoretical justification for it. And so I'm hoping that some of this may be useful in helping us to explain the longevity. They've done a lot of work on this. There's another guy, another physicist from Chile, who's not as well known. His name's Andres Escala. He's also done some very interesting work on this that may actually be an improvement on what West and these other guys have done. But what we're interested in, these things called life history invariants, things that stay the same. I'll give you an example. A real easy to understand example is that for mammals, pretty much all mammals have roughly 1.5 billion heartbeats in their lifetime.
Wow.
Now, here's why it's interesting. Now, you got little bitty things like shrews where their hearts beat really fast.
Yeah.
They have short lifespans. Mm. Okay. Organisms that are a lot bigger and their heart rate's a lot slower, they live longer. So here's something that at least in today's world stays the same, and you can use that to explain why mammals, the bigger ones live longer and the smaller ones live shorter lives, okay? So the question is, are there some things that would stay the same between the pre-flood and flood worlds? Or if they did change, can we figure out how they changed? And we might be able to use some of these relationships and show that when you change one variable, the greater longevity just pops out. That's mm-hmm. what I'm hoping. Mm-hmm. The tricky part, though, is what are the things that stay the same? That's the hard part. And I think that's the tricky part here.
Yeah. So that's a perfect transition just into my next question of what are some of those difficulties in determining the causes for greater longevity?
Well, one of those things is what are those things that stay the same?
Yeah.
For instance, for mammals today, you've got 1.5 billion heartbeats pretty much for all mammals. Would that number have changed in the flood? I suspect it was probably also true in the pre-flood world, but was it 1.5 billion heartbeats or was it some larger number? That's what we're not sure about. You know, there's another thing. When they do these studies of metabolism, you know, what they'll do is they'll, like a cow, they'll kind of fit it with some kind of mask, and they measure how much oxygen it's getting per unit time. In fact, your basal metabolic rate is often used as a stand-in or proxy for how much oxygen you're taking in per unit time. Okay, so when they do that, and then they figure out how much body heat they're radiating, they figure that 1 liter of oxygen translates to 20.1 thousand joules of energy. Okay, now the problem here is that seems to be experimentally determined. There doesn't seem to be any obvious theoretical justification for that. So would that number stay the same in the pre-flood world, or would it change? That's the part that's tricky, figuring out what would stay the same and what would change. That's what makes this hard.
Yeah. Well, of course, there's so many questions that are coming up that I know you're doing an excellent job just in diving into the research of those. And, you know, in the last episode, we talked a little bit about, of course, the animals, the evidence for animals being larger and living longer in the pre-flood world and, you know, afterwards as well. What about pre-flood humans? Can you talk a little bit more about that, just in whether they were even a little bit larger shortly after the flood, too?
Well, obviously, if you follow this chain of reasoning, it's kind of hard to avoid the conclusion that people may have been bigger as well. Mm-hmm. The only thing that I think is potentially controversial would be how much bigger. Mm-hmm. Because even the evolutionists acknowledge that ancient humans were a little bit bigger than we are. They were more robust, a little more massive, and I'm a little surprised at how many recent papers are suggesting they were also taller than we are. Mm-hmm. You're finding a lot of these fossil skeletons that are around 6 feet tall, which is, you know, based on what we've been taught all our lives that, you know, ancient man was short, you know. Yeah. It's kind of surprising to see that you're getting some of these that are so tall. And even evolutionists have used the word giant to describe them. Now, to be fair, when they use that word, they're using it as hyperbole, okay? Mm-hmm. Not the way most of us would use the word giant. But I've seen some of these evolutionists compare some of these ancient humans. They think they would have been comparable in size to maybe an NBA basketball player, mm-hmm. maybe a professional football player, things like that. So I do think they were probably bigger. And I don't think that in and of itself is controversial or would be controversial. It's just a question of how much bigger were they. That might arouse a little more controversy.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what we've talked about, like with the Bible giving these huge ages for humans, and you know them possibly also being larger. We aren't living to those long ages today. Obviously, no. I've never met someone who's over 200 years old.
Right, yeah.
And so with that, is this decline in longevity that we've seen throughout the ages reversible? Can we get enough technology to maybe actually start living longer and longer lives?
Well, I don't, as a practical matter, I don't think so. If it turned out that the atmosphere had something to do with it, you could theoretically build like a hyperbaric pressure chamber. And if you were willing to live in it for your entire life, maybe you could, you know.
Kind of a sad life.
it wouldn't be worth it.
Yeah.
I don't think as a practical matter, I don't think so. And I don't think the Lord is going to let us get away with doing it, you know, because he's shortened our lifespan. And by the way, this is a good example of how worldview matters. You know, you've got a lot of evolutionists out there. They want to tamper with the genome. They want to try to make us better. The problem is they don't know what they're doing. And when you try to tinker on something like our genetic code and you don't fully understand how it works, you're probably going to mess it up. And it's understandable to me that they want, I think a lot of us as humans deep down maybe sense that we're supposed to be more than we are now, better than we are now. Mm-hmm. And there's this tendency to want to try to grasp for that. And the problem is, I think God in Christ has made provision for that, but you've got to do it his way. Mm-hmm. The only way you're going to get back to that perfection is through Christ. And if you try to do it yourself, you're going to end up making a big mess of things. And so I think this is an example where having a correct understanding of why we've gone downhill, it is very important, because if evolutionists think strangely that we're getting better over time. Well, that doesn't really seem to be the case, I don't think. I think it's perfectly obvious that's not the case. But their worldview says we're supposed to be improving. Well, biblically, we're going downhill. And so how do you address that? And this is where getting it, your theology right matters. You got to have a correct understanding of what the cause is, because if you don't, you may end up making it worse. And so I think that's a warning about us trying to, on our own, try to improve ourselves. And I'm frankly also surprised at how many Christians just kind of take it for granted that this kind of stuff would work, that we could, like, you know, soup ourselves up by, you know, messing it around with their genomes. And I think it is far more likely we just make a mess of things, you know, because we don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not an auto mechanic and you start tinkering with an engine and a car, I don't think you're going to make it run better. You're probably going to make it run worse, you know. Yeah. But I do think there's hope, though, that we may get back to that one day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And what a testament to God's perfect design of humans, that we are so intricate, we can't even figure ourselves out, you know, and try to improve on ourselves.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you mentioned tinkering DNA and genetically, there's a lot of danger there.
Yeah.
Are there any other dangers just in humans trying to reach for some way to improve ourselves or live to eternity?
I think that's the main problem. And, you know, the thing is, I think it makes perfect sense that God did not allow Adam and Eve to live forever after they ate of the fruit. Because if they had lived in a very nearly perfect environment with a sinful heart, I have a feeling they would have gotten really bad. Mm-hmm. You know, I think deep down a lot of us know that hard times is good for us in a way, because it kind of restricts, you know, we talk about kids who get spoiled because they have it too easy. I think sometimes if we had had it too easy, if Adam and Eve had had it too easy after they had messed up, I think it could have been really bad. Of course, we see in the years after that, in the centuries after that, that's exactly what happened. People got really bad. And I think for us, mainly the main danger is we don't know what we're doing. We don't know what we're doing. And I'm sure my colleague, Jeff Tompkins, who's a geneticist, would 100% agree with that. But, you know, the thing is, there's hope. By the way, let me point something else out. You know, we're smaller today, but in today's environment, this might be the optimal body size. Okay? You know, this could be another example of continuous environmental tracking that Dr. Galuza has been advocating, that it may be, you know, animals were bigger in a different environment, and that may have been the optimal size for that environment and for those conditions. But in these less than optimal conditions, it may be that our current body size and current lifespan is about right. Yeah. So, you know, so there's that. And also, you know, I think there's hope. You know, the Bible, I think, offers hope that longevity is going to go back up again. Because in Isaiah 65, it talks about when Christ comes back, if someone dies at the age of 100, they will be thought a youth. But if they die before 100, they will be thought accursed. So I think there's biblical evidence that longevity is going to increase again when Christ comes back. I don't know if it's going to be as high as it was before the flood. But of course, not only that, Christ has conquered death. I mean, he's actually conquered it so that we can live forever. And I think it's going to be an upgrade. I don't think we're going to get just back to what Adam and Eve were. I think he originally intended to make us more than that, you know. And I think glorification, I think it's not just getting back to where Adam and Eve were. It's something beyond that. And I think that was his original intention for humanity. So as a Christian, we've got hope that death has been conquered, that these problems that we have are going to be fixed. But if you're an evolutionist, if you've got a wrong framework for interpreting the data, that can lead to some really bad stuff. And we've seen it. We've seen in the last century how evolutionary ideas have led to horrible suffering and to the deaths of tens of millions of people through things like communism and Nazism. And that's a warning. You know, bad ideas have very bad consequences. Mm-hmm. The Lord Jesus said, bad trees bear bad fruit, and evolution is a bad tree. And so, you know, there's hope, but it needs to come God's way through Christ.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I know at ICR we like to say that evolution is a death-driven worldview.
It is.
And ultimately, doesn't lead to life.
Right.
But even as you were talking, I was thinking of the verse, I think it's in Ecclesiastes where he has put eternity into man's heart.
Yeah.
And I just think it's so interesting that in all these attempts to try and expand our longevity, yeah. we're just ultimately reaching for this desire for eternity that God's innately put within us. And you had also mentioned continuous environmental tracking and that God has specifically designed us to live where we are today in this world.
And to flourish in that environment.
Yes. So could you explain a little bit more about CET and how that relates to this topic?
Well, basically, we are arguing that animals have built-in sensors that can detect changes in the environment, and they self-adjust. There's tons of evidence for this. For instance, the blind cavefish has often been used as a poster child for natural selection and evolution. But what we think is going on is these cave fish, when they go into this cave environment, you know, they have eyes, they have pigment. But when they get into that cave environment where eyes are no longer useful or not as useful, where you don't need pigment, they start becoming unpigmented. The eyes start recessing and in some cases go away completely. And this is happening quickly. It doesn't seem to be random. You know, evolution and natural selection says this is a random trial and error thing. It ought to take a very, very long time. But when we see these cavefish, they are quickly adjusting to these new environments. And there's tons of other examples of this as well. You know, there's evidence that animals, the wildlife around Chernobyl, have adjusted to some of that fallout from that nuclear disaster. And it's not affecting them as badly as you would expect. Because apparently God has put built-in sensors to detect when there's greater radiation, and they're responding to it. Mm-hmm. Okay, it doesn't mean that we can ignore radiation, that radiation's completely safe. I'm not saying that. Okay, what happened at Chernobyl was bad, but it's turning out not to be as bad as everybody thought it might be. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing all this evidence that animals self-adjust, mm-hmm. and I think the decrease in body size might be a very good example of that. It may be that under today's conditions, this is the optimal body size. Yeah.
Wow. And so what you're saying, it's not even something we consciously think about, like through the generations of changing, because
it's unconscious. And there's evidence this happens with the embryo in development, in utero. Yeah.
Wow. And so just over each generation, we see those adaptations happening because God designed us that way.
Yeah.
And how amazing that the Lord in his knowledge foreknew exactly where we'd be to be able to design our bodies perfectly.
Yeah, and the fact that he anticipated that we would be in changing conditions or could be in changing conditions where we would need to self-adjust, that's remarkable. Yeah. And it's an even more amazing argument for design. You know, it's one thing to design a space probe. It's another thing to design a space probe that when it gets to its new environment can detect changes in the environment and self-adjust to adapt, to be better suited to that environment. That takes a whole nother level of engineering. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're seeing here is it's not evolution, it's not natural selection, but it's even greater evidence of the Lord's handiwork in design and design the way he's designed living things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, it's so counter to what our society and our whole world will say. I know I grew up hearing about evolution and CET, and of course, these, claims of longevity that the Bible makes, we know they're true, but a lot of scoffers will say otherwise. So what would you say to a believer who's maybe in a school environment or workplace environment, somewhere where they're getting pushback on, this is what I believe about longevity, this is what I believe about, we didn't evolve to get here. What advice would you have for them to be able to refute those worldviews?
Well, I mean, our website, icr.org, is a great place to start. And we've got technical papers. We've got popular level articles that give summaries of this. So we've already got some short articles on longevity that have already been posted, and we're sharing some of this evidence already. So I think our argument that animals and humans were experiencing much greater longevity, I think that we're getting some fairly strong evidence for that. I think we're in a much stronger position than we were just even 1 or 2 years ago. And so I'm really excited about where this research is going. So we've got, you can learn more about our website. We may have some links posted below on this podcast that you can check out if you'd like to read more But we've got lots of resources.
Yeah. Yeah. And for supporters who are listening, who want to be able to encourage you in your research or just help with ICR as we pioneer this new path, how could they help? How can they encourage you?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, we would appreciate prayer for insight and wisdom, because we're trying to figure out stuff that's hard. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, for me at least, that's the thing I need the most. Mm-hmm. Even before we start trying to do sophisticated experiments, I feel like we need a better understanding of what's going on. Another thing that would be helpful, if there's some creationist paleontologists out there who want to do some field work, you know, there's plenty of clams and oysters out there. They could maybe do these kind of studies and maybe strengthen the argument that some of these animals were living longer or were taking longer to mature, which itself is indirect evidence for greater longevity. So there's a ton of field work that can be done. There's still a lot of papers that a lot of research that's already been published that we need to go through and look at. So we would appreciate prayer, and there's plenty of opportunities to help with the research if people want to do that.
That's awesome. And, you know, as we finish up, are there any closing remarks that you'd like to make, or anything that we didn't talk about today that you'd like to dive more into?
Not really. I mean, I think that pretty much covers it. But we're excited. We're excited about what we're doing here at ICR. We're really trying to move the ball forward. We don't want to get complacent. We want to keep pushing forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're living in a really exciting time with getting to be here at ICR and seeing this new research come to fruition, and just the things that you're discovering. And of course, with our CET research, I mean, that is counter to what anyone else is doing, right, which is really, really fun. So yeah. I've been so encouraged by our conversation today. So thank you so much for joining.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Renee.
Awesome. And to our listeners and viewers, thank you so much for tuning in to the Creation Podcast today. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to give it a like and to subscribe to our channel. And also, please share this with your family and friends. It really helps us to get the biblical creation message out there. And if you would like to receive the Creation Podcast a week early, or our monthly podcast, Creation.Live, 2 weeks early, please be sure to click the links in the description to become a member on YouTube or on Patreon. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.